Hello, welcome to episode one of the Serious About Security podcast for February 10th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, research engineer at SIRIUS. I also have a CISSP and also a CISA.
And I am Mike Hill, and I hold the CISSP certification.
This is the first of what we hope is a long line of security podcasts brought to you by the members of the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals. Again, I want to thank SIRIUS at Purdue University for helping make this podcast possible.
So for upcoming events at SIRIUS, we have on April 3rd and 4th, the 13th Annual Information Security Symposium here at Purdue. And this event will be held at the Lawson Computer Science Building. And every year, Professor Spafford, who's our executive director at SIRIUS, tends to bring in some interesting speakers for the symposium, and this year is no exception. On April 3rd, our opening keynote speaker will be Howard Schmidt. And Howard is the Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Cybersecurity in the Office of the U.S. President. Now, he came to campus a few years back, and I had the privilege of having lunch with him, and he's a very interesting guy and has a rich professional experience in information security. And then on April 4th, the keynote speaker will be Arthur Cavillo Jr., the chairman of RSA, which is the security division of EMC. The annual Information Security Symposium is also an opportunity for our students at SIRIUS to highlight and discuss their research projects with the attendees and sponsors. There'll be a Tech Talk poster preview in which students present their research projects in less than 60 seconds. And then immediately following that preview, there'll be an opportunity for the students, for attendees to meet with the students and discuss their projects in the poster session. Also, we'll have panel discussions on big data analytics, mobile device security, and SCADA system security. And we'll have a variety of panelists from academia, government, and industry. So for more information on our speakers and topics and to register for the symposium, please visit us at www.cerias.purdue.edu.
Just wanted to let everyone know that we just completed our February meeting of the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group. This past meeting, we held a workshop on advanced Metasploit. It was an exciting workshop. The next month's meeting is still in the planning stages, but we hope to have Matt Jonkman from Emerging Threats come talk to us. Please stay tuned for further updates. The March meeting will be on the 8th at 11:30 a.m. in Young Hall in room 647 on the Purdue campus.
In security news, Mozilla Firefox was updated to version 10 on February 1st. This update corrected 8 issues, and 5 of them were critical. Also, not to be outdone, Google Chrome released version 17 February 8th, which was 2 days ago. This will be an auto update for most users. So most people don't have to worry about updating their Chrome, but it did fix 8 high-risk issues and 1 critical issue. 10 of these bugs were discovered by someone using Address Sanitizer, which is a fast memory error detector and also an open-source tool on the Google Code site. Apple Mac OS X had a security update on February 1st, which had a significant changes to the operating system, including a upgrade to Apache, an upgrade to PHP. It addressed attacks on the confidentiality of SSL 3.0 and TLS 1.0, and other updates and corrections. In a few days, it'll be Microsoft Patch Tuesday, Microsoft is going to be releasing several updates, 4 of them for a critical remote code execution problems in Windows IE and Silverlight, and there are also five important bulletins relating to Windows OS Visio Viewer and SharePoint. And now we'll go over some articles. Keith Watson has the first one.
Yeah, so it's always interesting when you see government get involved in information security. And most of the time, the government is involved in their own information security. And so a lot of DoD funding is typically gone to develop, the internet, ARPANET at the time, and to build secure, multi-level secure operating systems. But what's interesting nowadays is there are attacks on what we've called critical infrastructure. And so now the Senate is looking at kind of regulating private industry's approach to information security. And so I linked to a Washington Post article that goes into that. And you know, the typical complaint here is that this is too heavy-handed, that government should let private industry figure out how to secure their systems. But the problem is that roughly 85% of our critical infrastructure is actually not owned by the government. And so in private hands, crippling that infrastructure would affect a good chunk of America's infrastructure. And so the government is now saying, hey, we need to take a look at this, and we need to mandate security and how that's addressed in these private industries. And so they've done some of this. If you look at HIPAA, it's kind of mandating security protections and controls over patient health information. And so there's a big discussion over how this is going to work. I think the biggest problem is that they're looking at DHS to run this. And I don't think that DHS is perhaps a great organization for, given their wide-ranging mission. I have my doubts as to whether this will actually go forward, but you never know.
Well, I think that the private sector has shown kind of the inability to regulate themselves when it comes to security. They have not done a good job doing this. So I think it's gotten to the point where the government says, if you don't start doing something, then we're going to step in and we're going to, you know, regulate you. Because these are critical infrastructure things. I mean, this is power and things like that that do run, even if it's owned by the private sector, does run government functions, like their servers and things like that. So, the government is dependent on these private sector.
Well, that's things. Why we call them critical infrastructure. And so, yes, so in the power industry, if you look at electrical distribution in North America, we have the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, which is a private-public partnership, if you will, which sets standards on how power producers and distributors maintain the security of their systems. And so in a sense, we do have this private organization that has some amount of standard setting and compliance checking against some of these infrastructures in terms of power. The question is, how else is there equivalence to that in other critical infrastructures? So I remember correctly, one of the critical infrastructures is listed as water systems. And the government owns a fair bit of the water systems, such as dams and that type of systems. But most of the water distribution we have in the U.S. is actually run by municipalities, or in some cases by private companies. And I don't know that they have an equivalent set of standards similar to the electrical distribution system that we have. So that might be an interesting case where a similar approach to the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, and I'm sure I'm butchering their name, but it's called NERC, that maybe that approach could be considered for some of the other infrastructures that we do that are are of concern, let's say.
Well, let me ask, how real is the threat? You know, my thought is, if I'm maintaining a critical system, even as a private industry, I'm going to be very careful to make sure that system's available 24/7. Do we have any real examples of failures? Because I've heard this from several conferences, the doomsday theory that, you know, the whole network, the whole grid can go offline. And I've seen it in movies play out, and it's pretty horrific. But how real is the threat? You know, are these companies not already invested in making sure that those systems operate?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, anytime we do risk analysis, we want to know what the threat is. What is it that we're that is causing the issues? And we haven't seen that, at least. We hear anecdotal stories here and there about, oh, somebody broke into this computer system and caused the release of sewage into a river, for example. But those seem to be few and far between. The question I would have is, since these are private organizations and there may not be a reporting requirement in all industries, are we missing information? Are attacks actually happening, or are they happening and no one's noticing, which is often the case, having been to several organizations where they actually turn off their log data because it takes up all their disk space. They don't have any idea of what's going on in their network. And so I wonder if this is a case where we need to get more information. We're operating in a vacuum of information. We don't actually know what's going on out there in the way we probably could.
Well, I think a prime example of a failing of a SCADA system is Iran. Now, those are government-run systems, but I think that might be part of the concern is that, you know, they had a lot of damage done to their, or they claimed they had a lot of damage done to their infrastructure via an attack. And obviously they're a huge target for these types of attacks from other people and government entities. But I think that might be one example of an attack that has happened.
That is certainly an example of an attack. However, the question is, in that case, was that a government actor that brought that attack apart, about? I suspect I'm going to put my conspiracy theory hat on and say, yeah, probably. But the question is, what as our own infrastructure could be similarly vulnerable? Is it likely that we're going to see more targeted attacks similar to that? And then what will be the response to that? Now, the Department of Defense has a policy that says, if you attack our systems through cyberspace, that's the term they use. That's not my favorite, but that's the term they used. All options are on the table, as President Bush used to say, which means, oh, yeah, we might lob some bombs at you. So we haven't seen that yet, at least as far as has been reported. But I think until that threat of physical attack in response to a cyber attack actually happens, there's a lot of question as to what our policy is going to be. And I think that this attempt from the Senate is to say, well, let's harden our own infrastructure because we don't know what the retaliation could be, either from a non-government entity or from a government-sponsored entity. So that'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, and I think you make an interesting point. A lot of times when I'm talking with friends and family about cyber attacks, I think it's hard to relate it to a physical act or that real damages. And I always kind of come back to the story of, well, so what if someone breaks my password? You know, I use a weak password. What's the big deal? It's like, well, do you use that same password for your bank? You know, do you use the same ID? Can they, you know, take away your physical money because you're playing a game online and you think it's not important to, you know, use a secure connection or protect that data? So I think that's part of the challenge and these threats is that, you know, these critical infrastructures, I think a lot of people, and I tend to do this naturally as well, is I kind of think of them being offline. I keep thinking, well, you know, it's kind of crazy to have them connected to the internet, accessible that way, because that makes them more more of a target. But then, you know, you think through things, and it's like, well, it's hard for a system nowadays not to have some connection to the outside world, to the internet, because there's so much functionality that's available through it. So I think it's a major challenge. But the sense I get is until there's a big headline and something happens, a lot of the folks in the security field that said this is a threat and this could happen, it's you know, it's foreseen as being hypothetical and far-fetched, and no, that can never happen. That's something you'll see in a movie, but it's not a real probability that it ever come to light. And my sense is that it's just, you know, the scenario, you know, there's a lot of things in place where it could happen. It just hasn't yet.
Yes, and it's not surprising that there's a need to get more information out of these systems, and hooking them up to a network is a way that it's done. I have my own story of finding a SCADA system on a network that I was doing an assessment for. And this system was so weak, you could telnet directly to it, and you were, well, it had no sense of administrator. You just had complete control over it. And it was a WINCE machine, a Windows CE device controlling pumps and a tank and temperature, and it was completely open.
Wow.
And connected to their network. So that was a lot of fun to report that one. It's always fun to find them when you're the assessor. Less so when you're actually the person being assessed.
That's scary.
Okay, well, the next article that we have is about comes from Google. Google has decided that they're going to get rid of SSL revocation checking for Chrome, and I think this is an interesting decision that they've made. This system for checking for the revocation of certificates has been used for the past, well, maybe 6 or 7 years. Checking revocation lists. Google claims that it is, I've heard them quoted, that it's like having a seatbelt in your car that breaks when you get in an accident, because it gives you this illusion that there's some security there, but when something actually happens, it just doesn't work. they've offered some possible new systems for it, but there are none in place. So basically, they're taking out what I consider a security device that may or may not work, and replacing it with nothing.
Yeah, there's no transition from a mediocre system to a better system. We're just going to cut this off and hope for the best in the future. I like their approach that they have, where the CAs would contribute their revoked their CRL list. And then Google would crawl that and then basically send that to your browser ahead of time to cut down on this delay of actually doing the online certificate status check. And so the problem there is there's no easy transition from a system that works. Yeah, it's kind of slow. It may not be the best, but they're hoping for something that they've got to get the CAs to buy into and all the organizations associated with that. And so it remains to be seen whether this is a good move or not.
Well, my concern is they're taking something out that may or may not work and replacing it with absolutely nothing. It's just kind of taking out a somewhat secure, possibly useful system and putting nothing in its place. Although, you know, I've noticed when it's turned on, they've also said that it can create, you know, second delay in loading a page and make the pages themselves look bad just because it takes a while to load and things like that. And I guess we'll see what happens. See if it causes any problems. I mean, the latest, we've had quite a few security certificates that were compromised and revoked. And pretty much in every instance, every single browser manufacturer released an update for their browser and didn't rely on the system to work. And Microsoft, Firefox, Google, Apple all released revocations within their web browsers for the latest certificate problems.
Yes, and the problem with that, though, is, and we're talking about DigiNotar, who was hacked, and somebody was able to get in their system and issue their own certificates that were tied to Google's domain. And the problem there is that in each of our browsers, we have a list of trusted CAs. These are the anchors of trust in a certificate infrastructure. And so in the DigiNotar case, even if you had revoked those certificates, it wouldn't have helped you as much because the whole CA system for DigiNotar was the problem. And so the only way to go back and fix the browser so they could ignore certain certificates in that case was to remove that CA as the trusted anchor for PKI. So anything that was signed by DigiNotar CA would be effectively no longer trusted. And so that was a case where, because of the poor security of that one organization, all these browsers had to be updated because their basically their trusted list of CAs had to change. And so that's certainly one significant problem. And also, if you look through the number of trusted CAs in any browser, that list is getting longer and longer all the time. And how much trust do we have in these organizations? And there are lots of standards for having a certification practice standard, which defines, it's like a policy, defines everything they do in terms of verifying who's getting a certificate and how they sign it and how those keys are protected. But there's no enforcement of that. And here's a case where somebody didn't protect their CA properly, got hacked as a result of it, and a bunch of certs were issued that shouldn't have been. And that just made significant issues down the road. And so our PKI system here is in question, in my mind. I mean, are we doing it the right way? Is there something we could do when it comes to PKI now that we have a global system and we have so much trust in these sites and in these certs? I'm wondering if we're missing something here. And it looked good on paper. It worked well in small organizations. But now we're talking about billions of people around the planet here having trust in a system that has little or no oversight. It's a free market system. You can certainly take your certs to a different CA. But how do you know that that CA is more secure than the one you were using or anybody else out there?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and in this instance, specifically with Google, we're talking about just moving your trust to Google, essentially trusting Google that they're going to be doing the right things and not abusing their authority. And you know, it's probably better than trusting, I don't even know, hundreds of certificate authorities out there. You're already kind of trusting Google. You're already kind of trusting Mozilla because you're trusting them to trust the right people because they have to put their stamp essentially on the certificate authorities they put in within their web browsers. So you're kind of already trusting them, and we'll just see how it goes, I guess.
It'll be interesting to see if anybody else takes a similar approach.
Well, yeah, that's my thought on the whole thing is Chrome is going outside of the line of what all the other browsers are doing. So essentially, we've been following a standard, and now they're going to take a different approach. So if other browsers decide to take the same stance, you know, how many different lists or versions would there be? You know, how do you know which one to trust in? Right now, even though it's a flawed system, like you said, when a CA gets pulled, all the major browsers update, and you know whether you're running Chrome or Firefox or Safari or IE, they've updated their lists. What Chrome seems to be doing is going saying, well, we're going to just manage our own set of lists. We're going to decide who we want to trust and who we do not want to trust. So when something happens, when you hear of a DigiNotar or something, how transparent is it going to be? Are you going to know Chrome has already removed them? And are you going to feel secure then when you go over to Safari? If all the others implemented a similar approach, would you know?
Okay. I think that's, now we have Mike's article.
Okay. The final article comes from SC Magazine, and it discusses the fact that attacks could steal the HTC Wi-Fi codes with a malicious app. And according to US CERT, there are 9 models of the HTC that are affected by this. And essentially, the issue in these HTC builds of Android is that the 802.1x password could be exposed to the access Wi-Fi state permission. And this was discovered by researchers Brett Jordan and Chris Hessing. And what they said is when paired with the permission internet, that those passwords could then be sent to a remote server and collected. Now, the good news is that HTC has already made a fix available for some models. They'll, you know, can be automatically updated. For other models, they may need to be installed manually. And another piece of good news is that Google has scanned the applications in its marketplace to ensure that there are no applications trying to take advantage of this vulnerability. So I thought this was an interesting article to discuss because, you know, it highlights how an app on our smartphones, how they can be vulnerable. But the question I really want to discuss is, you know, how worried should we be about this? You know, if I'm using an HTC phone at a Starbucks, then, you know, or I guess that's not a good example. If I'm using it at, you know, a university setting where I have my credentials, someone's able to get in there, how much can they do with that? And is it just that they're getting access to a wireless network? Or, you know, how concerned should I be if I'm an HTC user? What are your guys' thoughts?
Well, it's, again, the vulnerability is in the operating system of the phone. You still have to have a malicious app there that can read that data off and forward it on somewhere else. And again, I don't trust a significant portion of the apps that are in the Google App Store. And they have a different model, business model, from, say, Apple. And it's not clear that Apple's model is better in terms of the security of applications that you could get. And so it's good that they look through what's out there to see if somebody's taking advantage of it or not. But still, I thought, and maybe I was wrong, but I thought that the Android phone was supposed to be better for security because of the sandbox model that it supposedly used. And yet, here's a case where even in that model, information can still be extracted from the phone and used. And so, while there's no, or at least there's none believed to be malicious today, there's nothing to stop a malicious app from getting introduced to the marketplace at some point. So their review process is of any application is pretty much non-existent compared to the Apple approach. And I'm not saying the Apple approach is much better, but anytime we're loading apps from third-party developers from places we don't have any idea, you'd hope that the operating system in which those apps run have some amount of protection. And again, that assumes that your phone operating system has fewer vulnerabilities.
Yes, and not to pick on Android here, I'm a user of Android and Apple devices, fairly new to Android. But one of the things, you know, as I was researching this article, and how it's impacted, you know, in this case, it's the HTC devices, but it's only certain ones. And, you know, I'm still trying to get my mind around how these Android OSs work, you know, the different versions compared to Apple's model, where basically you're running a particular version of an iOS, and if it's vulnerable, then you know what version it is. It seems like with Android, it's more dependent on, you know, there's different flavors of Android, and then there's even with similar devices, you know, it's, you know, it's only particular models, and that surprises me a bit. And I think maybe I'm not clued into everything that's happening with it, but you know, just the fact that, you know, they always say complexity makes things more difficult to secure, and to me, as a new user of Android devices, it seems a little complex. You know, trying to figure out exactly what version and on what platform I'm running. Whereas with the Apple devices I've used before, it's kind of like there's one version, and you know the version that you're on.
Well, the Apple model is we sell one phone, and there's one OS for it. And in Android, it's open source. So the handset manufacturers have their version of the operating system, and then when they go to the Sprints and Verizons and AT&Ts, then they also say, well, yeah, we want that phone, but tweak this. Take that feature out or add this new feature or put in the Sprint NASCAR app as a default, right? And so while Android has a version from Google, that's not the version you get on these devices. They're heavily modified by handset makers and by the phone companies. And so that's part of the problem. And that makes it also difficult to say, well, I want the latest version for my HTC Hero, because Sprint stopped supporting the HTC Hero a year ago and literally months after I bought the silly thing. And so there are no updates available for that. There won't be any updates for it. So now I've got to go and find a third-party ROM and root the phone and put my own version of Android on there if I want to stay up to date with updates. And that's not within the realm of your average user, unfortunately. And these are very expensive phones, so they're going to hold on to them potentially longer because they spent so much money up front to get the silly thing. So they're going to have a vulnerable phone for a much longer period of time when there are no updates available for it.
Yes, and that was some of my concern in seeing the article, is that, you know, what I was pleased to see was there are updates available, and for those lucky enough to get the automatic updates, I think it's another example of why we want to keep our systems up to date so that we can avoid these types of things. But like I said, as you start looking at it further, you know, I think we all need to know the devices that we have and what versions are at, and to understand that process. That, like I said, I'm fairly new to Android, so I was just waiting for like a little update light to come on and say, oh, there's an update available. But chances are I may need to go out and find, you know, manually install an update so that I can get the device up to date and where it needs to be. So, you know, I think that's an important consideration as you have these devices.
Well, I think one problem with phones, at least that I've seen, is updates. I mean, HTC is a, you know, they're releasing updates, but there's some phone manufacturers that don't support their phones at all. That, you know, you get the phone, you know, you get the OS on it, and you're done. I mean, there's no updates. And I guess we can be thankful if you have one of these phones that you can get updates, but I know that some phone manufacturers don't support really their phones as well as HTC does. So that and with Android, that is I mean, that phone manufacturers can customize it, they can rewrite the code, they can do what they want, and obviously HTC made a mistake, so, and they're fixing it. But you know, I've seen some phones where there is no, you know, you get the phone and, you know, you have to live with what's on it. And I don't think that's, I think the model needs to change a little bit on how vendors support their phones if they're going to be, you know, using an Android or whatever. I wish Google and phone manufacturers would kind of figure this out a little bit more than having this whole, you know, different version of Android for all these different devices that each different vendor has to support and maintain and things like that. So I don't know how to fix that.
The problem is that Google had big expectations that they'd be able to change this marketplace in some respects and offer a new way of doing business with software on these phones. And I don't think that's worked out as well as they'd hoped.
Yes, and I think as more of these issues come to light, that they'll work towards that model. Just anyone who owns an Android device just kind of needs to be aware of it. And if you're in the market to purchase a new one, maybe do some research up front to see how easily it is to get updates to that device after you make that big purchase.
Well, that's our podcast. I wanted to thank the host Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.